Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Basis Technologies. This is the Friday show that reviews the most shock and awe media news stories of the week. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. What's next for Twitter after Jack?
You know, Twitter has lagged Snapchat, you know, TikTok, of course, but even Facebook with product innovation for years now, that's never a good thing.
Moving on from the one great ad approach.
I've never been a fan of those, you know, advertisements that look like it's a movie trailer and then they flash the logo at the end of the 30 seconds. So I'm kind of glad that the competition has whittled down to that first second or two.
Can anyone become the audio app?
I couldn't help notice how many times the word Audible was mentioned in this article, so I would guess that Amazon remains the 800-pound gorilla in the space.
Did the internet break brand loyalty? How not to make virtual office holiday parties awful? And where in the world doesn't acknowledge daylight savings? All right, folks, joining me for this episode, we have three people, three very familiar voices. Let's meet them. We start with our Director of Reports Editing. It's Rahul Chadha.
Hi, guys.
Hey, chat. We're also joined by one of our analysts on the retail and e-commerce team. It's Blake Drosh.
Hey, everyone.
And finally, we have one of our Directors of Forecasting. It's Oscar Orozco.
Thanks for having me, Marcus.
Hey. So, thanks, gents, for hanging out. What do we have in store for the listeners today? Well, we're starting with the story of the week. What's next for Twitter after Jack Dorsey steps aside? We then move to the game of the week, where our contestants Rahul, Blake and Oscar will give us the best takeaways they can from each of the four stories we have for you to try to win points, to try to win the championship belt. We then move to Working From Somewhere, where we talk about what it's like to work from somewhere and that, how that's changed our lives. And finally, Dinner Party Data, where we talk about random trivia that we have just recently learned about. We start with the story of the week, as per usual. What's next for Twitter after Jack, or Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, who first scribbled the idea of Twitter on a legal pad back in 2006, is stepping down this coming May. This ends his second stint at the company. He was pushed out in 2008 by Twitter's board, just 2 years after starting the company with Noah Glass, Biz Stone and Evan Williams, then came back again 7 years later in 2015. Jack will be replaced by CTO Parag Agrawal, who has been with the firm for over a decade. Reuters sources say Jack Dorsey is stepping down now because he feels confident about his successor and will focus on his payments processing firm Square, which just changed its name to Block, and other things like philanthropy. The company's board has supposedly been preparing for Dorsey's departure since last year. Gents, initial reactions. News just broke on Monday of this week.
My initial reaction was, honestly, I hadn't thought about Twitter in a very long time. You know, just from a marketing and advertising perspective, I looked up some of our internal numbers and, you know, we predict that Twitter's monthly active user numbers will actually decline over the next few years. And, you know, Twitter has a 1.1% share of the U.S. digital ad revenues this year. So it's kind of a non-player, I think, still in this space. Just reading some of the clips you sent over, Marcus, obviously they're trying to pivot to, like, you know, new business models to generate kind of subscription-based revenues to incentivize content creators. But yeah, I think, you know, Twitter is trying to figure out how else it can make money aside from advertising. And just my general sense, without knowing very much about it, is that Dorsey's been kind of there's a general sense out there, I think, that Dorsey's been a somewhat of an absentee CEO for Twitter and maybe more focused on Square.
Yes, that seems to definitely be some of the concern. They were saying now Twitter has a full-time CEO. The market reacted positively as soon as the announcement was made. Jack Dorsey's been running Twitter and Square at the same time. Twitter's done relatively well, especially since the pandemic, but not good enough in terms of stock gains since the pandemic. Twitter at 52%, that's still behind Meta, Facebook, Snapchat, and Pinterest, according to FactSet. So yeah, I think the investors are happy to have someone who's full-time focusing on Twitter.
Also, to further contextualize with our internal estimates as well, Rahul mentioned that Twitter makes about 1.2% of all ad revenues. When looking just at social platforms, it only comes out to about 4%. So it's pretty small. Yeah, so consider that. I mean, I think, you know, sort of talking about Jack Dorsey, and, you know, I'm more just surprises hasn't happened earlier. The shareholders have been pushing for him to step away for years now, years. I remember hearing first about this maybe in 2017 or 2018. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me. Surprise didn't happen earlier. You know, Twitter has lagged Snapchat, you know, TikTok, of course, but even Facebook with product innovation for years now, that's never a good thing. And I would just further add, you know, looking at some of their new products that they've sort of been launching, all right, the tips and the creator fund, you know, for influencers, those make sense, but it's kind of playing catch up with Instagram and Snapchat and you know, other platforms like that. So it's nothing super innovative. The communities aspect, I mean, that just looks entirely like Facebook's, you know, sort of value prop at this point. So lagging behind there. The only one that I thought was kind of bright and interesting was the live audio or the spaces feature where it allowed recordings of live audio conversations to be held in this feature. I think that's more of what they should lean into. It could be something where they kind of lead the social space in the coming years. So those were my thoughts kind of on these new product launches.
Yeah, it's interesting because you could argue, is it a good time to leave now? Yes, because Twitter does need to innovate more and it's worked on some product feature updates like communities, like Twitter Blue, its subscription project. But you could also argue that maybe it's not a great time at the minute. Sarah Fisher of Axios and Ashley Gold were also mentioning that Twitter's in the midst of its biggest transformation yet, that kind of to what Rahul was saying, moving from an ad-based social network focused on text to a subscription-based platform centered on smaller communities and multimedia. Did Jack think that it was the right time to leave now? Or, as Shirin Ghaffari of Recode notes, would Jack still be in charge if he had more power over Twitter's board and if he grew the company at an expansive scale like Facebook?
I don't really think it's ever going to be a good time to be the CEO of Twitter as long as it sort of exists in the current state that it's in.
Yeah.
Because as Rahul and Oscar mentioned, you know, they're not a player in the ad game. They're not terribly loved by Wall Street in terms of tech stocks. And, you know, my neck of the woods with e-commerce, people are not super excited at, they're not excited at all about, you know, capabilities for, you know, Twitter enabling social commerce. I think it has this niche cultural relevancy that's going to persist, sort of similar to the way that Reddit does, where it's going to be hard for them to really expand beyond their really general use cases as just social networks go, which is, you know, a frustrating place for someone who wants to come in as the leader of a company and innovate, because I do think that is kind of boxed in. But I would say maybe the silver lining there is that company like Twitter, you know, Reddit, they fly under the radar where Facebook and to a slightly lesser extent TikTok get a lot of heat from regulators. They're the ones that are always talked about in, you know, controversial ways in terms of what their impact on, you know, larger society is. And, you know, it's not to say that Twitter and Reddit, they don't, you know, get their own fair share of criticism. They do. But maybe not being the one, you know, in the spotlight 100% of the time can have its advantages in the long term. But I think what we're going to be looking at here is when this CEO comes in and starts to, you know, we know his background, big into tech, interested in crypto, blockchain, things like that. Is he going to take the Dorsey effect of trying to stick Twitter's beak, no pun intended, into where, you know, maybe doesn't belong?
Yeah. Yeah, PhD of computer science from Stanford, been with the company 10 years, been CTO, Mr. Agrawal, been CTO for a couple of years now. Looking at the two separately for a second, so with Jack and then with Twitter. With Jack, it's interesting because this, I felt like a bit of a shot across the bow at Mark Zuckerberg, because as he left, he said, he talks about the importance of a company being founder-led and ultimately believing that that's severely limiting and a single source of failure. And he is trying to break away from that. And then with regards to Mr. Dorsey stepping aside, I mean, it seems like a great time for him personally, because now he can focus on Square, which, as a Wall Street Journal article by George Wells and Kristen Grind pointed out, Square's got a market cap that's double that of Twitter's, $100 billion. Twitter's just under $40 billion. So it makes a lot of sense for Mr. Dorsey. Also makes a lot of sense given that he just presented some very aggressive targets for the company. So Mr. Agrawal, who's going to be the new head of Twitter, is going to have to somehow find 300 million monetizable daily active users by 2023 and double their annual revenue to $7.5 billion. So in 2 years' time. That they seem like insane goals. I went to look at how they've done the last 2 years since Q1 2019. So in those 2.5 years since then, Twitter's added 80 million. They're looking to add another 100 in the next 2 years. And revenue is up nearly 70%. Although it's pretty impressive considering that's through a pandemic and a recession. So I'm not sure how to look at those goals. Too aggressive or maybe achievable? I imagine they'll come in a fair amount below, but that would still be pretty impressive, all things considered. The two points I think I'll end with, gents, are kind of looking further into the future, if you will, both from the Economist article. One is that Twitter's new CEO, Mr. Agrawal, and Jack work closely together on Twitter's recent changes and share two long-term goals for the firm. One, to turn Twitter into a crypto company, maybe introducing a Twitter coin to allow users to tip authors of good tweets. Number two, the second long-term goal, is to fashion Twitter into a decentralized undertaking, or as Jack puts it, a standard for the public conversation layer of the internet. Instead of remaining a unified social media service, it would become a platform on which other companies could, for example, compete with offerings that filter Twitter's massive volume of content. This is the effort called Project Blue Sky, which they're currently working on. And the second point from the Economist article, very interesting. When announcing his successor, Mr. Dorsey presented a new chairman of the board, of Twitter's board, called Brett Taylor. Brett Taylor happens to be the president and COO of Salesforce, and Mr. Taylor is also expected to take over from Mark Benioff, who's Salesforce's co-founder and chief executive, sometime soonish. Mr. Taylor was just promoted to co-CEO alongside Benioff a few days ago. So the Economist was saying perhaps the two firms, which in 2016 broke off merger talks, could eventually become one. That is all we have time for the story of the week. Time now for the game of the week. First quick word from our sponsor, Basis Technologies. Today's podcast is made possible by Basis Technologies. Basis Technologies has created a digital advertising platform that connects people, automates processes, and unifies channels, bringing together programmatic, site direct, search, social, and CTV into one single interface. And through the power of automation, Basis enable brands, agencies, and publishers to build and operate a healthy, secure, efficient, and profitable advertising organization. Ready to take control of your advertising? Just go to basis.net today. That's www.basis.net. Basis Technologies, the future of advertising has arrived. Folks, we are back. It's time now for the game of the week. Today's game, What's the Point? Where we read out four stories and have our contestants, Rahul, Blake and Oscar, tell us what they think is the main takeaway of the story. Okay answers will get you 1 point, good answers get two, and Chef Curry level answers get you 3 points. Victoria made me use that basketball reference. I'm of course kidding. It pains her when we talk about sports. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this. Whoever has, there was a delay there because I missed the bell. I went for it and I missed it completely.
Let's try and keep it together, Marcus.
My job is difficult. It's not. Whoever has the most points after four rounds wins and gets the last word. We start with Rahul. Video advertisers moving on from that one great ad approach. Variety and iteration are attracting more attention on YouTube, writes Abhyan Kar, CEO of creative management platform adlib.io. One great ad won't convince multiple audiences, he continues. The key is to move away from the old thinking that has shaped TV and video ads, that one great idea will lead to one great ad. YouTube continues to pull in advertisers, but not just because of its huge audience, but because this platform is the perfect battleground for advertisers who want to conquer the purchase journey's messy middle. Mr. Abhyan Kar suggests shaping your ads to help folks sort through this messy middle. Rahul, moving on from the one great ad approach, what's the point?
I mean, if I'm understanding what this man's argument was correctly, he's saying that personalized creative at scale is going to, you know, drive returns. And yeah, of course it will, but that's the holy grail. And I think what his argument was that there's technology that can enable this, and I wouldn't be surprised if he works for a company that offers such a solution. But
there's a good chance.
Yeah, I think the issue is that if you have a piece of technology that's supposed to generate quality creative that's personalized, I'm going to be doubtful of the quality of that creative, I guess is my main takeaway from that. And if you want to create a bunch of different creative and test it, like he suggests, you're going to be drowning, one, not only in creative, but two, in a bunch of data. It's just going to suck up your time and resources. So I think it's a tall order.
Blake,
Yeah, you know, I totally agree with Rahul as being sort of just general idea, but it did get me thinking about sort of how the, you know, 5 second skip ad really does, and the aspect about having, you know, be able to catch the line or catch the person's attention in like the first, you know, second of the clip is good for advertising, because I don't know, for one, I've never been a fan of those, you know, advertisements that look like it's a movie trailer and then they flash the logo at the end of the 30 seconds. So I'm kind of glad that the competition has whittled down to that first second or two.
Oscar.
Kind of honing in on what was discussed, aside from the personalization thing, what I thought was very interesting, we've talked about it before on this show, but kind of limiting the frequency of an ad and how key that is to the viewer. So showing an ad over and over, it's a problem we've talked about, especially with the AVOD platforms. It's not a recipe for success. So, you know, ad fatigue and exposure is real. That's what I kind of focused in on. And I think it's what brands should also focus on into 2022.
Let's start with Blake for story two. Can anyone become the audio app? Spotify's latest purchase of an audiobook company, Findaway, is about becoming the place you listen to everything, writes Ashley Carmen of The Verge. Ms. Carmen imagines that when you open Spotify this time next year, the app will likely highlight an Armchair Expert podcast episode alongside Taylor Swift's newest single, alongside Barack Obama's newest audiobook. It'll be crowded, but a potentially powerful destination. Blake, can anyone become the audio app? What's the point?
Yeah, and the point is, like, I am an avid reader myself, but I don't think when you're comparing music and podcasts to audiobooks that adding audiobooks to a platform is going to revolutionize Spotify. It's kind of like a no-brainer that, yeah, they should have audiobooks as an offering. But the way that this article was written really positioned it, like adding audiobook feature to Spotify is going to be like this game changer, where I highly doubt that anyone's even really going to notice that they've added this feature.
Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a Spotify truther for a long time. I'm a big fan. yeah, I mean, I think it, like sort of what Blake's saying, it just makes sense. It's not this huge, innovative, big project that will do much for the platform, but, you know, kind of what we were talking about with Twitter, where it appears they're trying to do too much. We mentioned this earlier. It makes sense for Spotify to keep honing in on the podcast thing and into the audiobooks. It just makes a ton of sense for me. It's been proven that those Spotify subscribers who are users who listen to podcasts are more likely to subscribe. We estimate that 34% of Spotify users are listening to podcasts now. That'll grow to about 44% wow. In 4 years. So it's an increasingly big, huge part of that platform. And these podcast listeners are more engaged. So this just moving into audiobooks makes a ton of sense. It shouldn't be a heavy lift. So, you know, it's a good move for them.
I remember that number being 25% quite recently. So that's moving quickly.
Yep.
Rahul.
I know next to nothing. Well, actually, I know nothing about how audiobook distribution works, but I couldn't help notice how many times the word Audible was mentioned in this article. So I would guess that Amazon remains the 800-pound gorilla in the space. I don't know enough about like how their moat or potential moat works to keep competitors away, but I would expect they might have some kind of advantage by tying incentives between physical book sales and audiobooks that might appeal to book publishers or authors. I just don't know enough about how the space works, but I'd be curious to find out if, you know, what they're really trying to do is figure out a way to defeat Amazon where they made their bones, which is in book selling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ms. Carmen also envisions Spotify offering direct subscription tiers that let paying subscribers download an audiobook once a month, a la Audible and others. It could also try to launch an unlimited audiobooks plan like its Swedish competitor Storytel. And there's a possibility of Spotify signing exclusive deals with publishers, authors to bring books to its platform like Audible as well.
Right, because books have too big of a reach. We got to hone those in and make them exclusive. Too many people are getting their hands on these books.
The second thing I wanted to note quickly is from a separate article from Axios, and it was a 2021 spoken word audio report from NPR and Edison Research showing the types of spoken word audio content Americans listen to. So radio, podcasts, audiobooks, etc. Of all of the spoken word content, what are the shares within that? And this was looking at from 2014 to today. Radio's share of spoken word audio listening went from 80% in 2014 to 48% today, from 80 to 48 over 7 years. Podcasts went from 8 to 22, and audiobooks, which they started tracking in 2017, went from 7% to 10% in the last few years. So to your guys' points about not maybe making the splash that Spotify perhaps hopes, that seems to be the case, at least according to these numbers. Story three, we start with Oscar, Nielsen's major TV measurement change. Nielsen will measure individual ads as it overhauls its rating system, writes Jack Neff of Ad Age. He notes that Nielsen is about to give advertisers something they've been asking for at least 15 years, ratings of individual commercials in linear TV. Nielsen will start to make the change in 2022 and hopes to have the new system in place by fall 2024. To make this happen, Nielsen is working with Extreme Reach to allow for encoding the vast majority, in quotes, of all linear TV commercials with Nielsen's watermarks to facilitate the measurement. Mr. Neff notes the current C3 measurement, widely used today as a currency for TV deals, is based on average ratings for all commercials in a program rather than individual spots. Oscar, Nielsen's major TV measurement change, what's the point?
I mean, this is massive, you know, if it ends up working out. I mean, the big question for me is what took so long? Really, what took so long here? Yeah. You know, there's no way to minimize the impact, you know, Nielsen ratings have, you know, on advertisers and on content production and, you know, whether something is or a series is canceled or greenlit for additional seasons. Nielsen is still the stalwart there. It's been in need of good PR too. So they definitely need to focus on being as transparent as possible with their methodology just to, you know, ensure that the data is as accurate as possible. So, you know, massive news there for Nielsen.
Raul.
Yeah, I think just to add to Oscar's point, it seems like Nielsen's just a lumbering incumbent that's sclerotic in its changes and is trying to catch up with the times at this point. You know, I think they're seeing the writing on the wall, but, you know, they, I think, have all the factors that make them ripe for disruption. They had an effective monopoly for a long time. They're probably charging their clients a lot of money. And, you know, some of the articles you pointed out said that a consortium of networks are trying to band together to create a competing product that'll help them understand metrics in a way that is like native to the digital world and trying to bring that to linear TV. And not just that, but, you know, as what we think of as traditional TV is increasingly delivered through digital pipes. You know, it's, the expectation is going to be that they, people can have the same level of metrics that they would for digital campaigns.
Blake.
Yeah, I mean, this type of stuff is pretty far outside of my coverage area, but I do read about it from time to time, and it does feel like I've read this article about Nielsen having something coming several years away. That sounds like a really big deal. So I will defer to our other colleagues at this company who are far more knowledgeable than I am about linear television measurement to tell me whether or not it's a big deal or if it's just another article that I'll be reading again in a year.
We'll see. Final round, the internet broke brand loyalty. Shira Overday of the New York Times writes that one way that our lives online have rewired our brains is that we're more comfortable buying from an unfamiliar brand. And those same changing habits may also be making us less loyal to anything that we buy. Gone are the days of one brand being stocked at the local store. Now you can find millions of brands online. Rahul, the internet breaking brand loyalty, what's the point?
Yeah, this is a fascinating trend to me. I think it raises a host of questions. You know, I was actually thinking about something that Blake wrote about social commerce increasing a new type of discovery, product discovery. And so where does the consumer's brand loyalty lie? In that case, their loyalty might lie with the influencer maybe and not the product. Or in some cases, their loyalty lies with the retailer and not necessarily the product. I think powerhouse brands like Nike come to mind as a great example of companies that can build on their innate brand power and make the kind of seamless shift to online channels. But I think most companies are going to struggle that way. And it is interesting to see that this idea of brand loyalty might be withering away.
Blake.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing about how it is sort of the influencer, the creator now that has sort of assumed the role as the local retailer that has sort of the trusted recommendation on what is the right product. And But I will counter and say that I don't think brand loyalty has totally been killed by the internet. I think this was a really interesting article, and a lot of the categories that were being referenced, yes, for sure. But I think in things like apparel, there's still plenty of room for brand building, and even through social media. I think that, you know, certain verticals can actually be really effective about building their own brand by leveraging their digital channels.
Oscar.
I would also add, I was going to talk about the product categories and how it is, you know, it does depend on what we're looking at. As Blake mentioned, apparel, luxury goods still, you know, leads to more brand loyalty. With the CPG, you know, food and beverage type products, you know, it's more brand agnostic there. So that'll remain to be the case. But I would just add one thing. You know, millennials, Gen Z, their purchasing power continues to grow and grow. And one of the things that they care less about is brand loyalty. I don't foresee that changing as they age. I think it's sort of a new reality that brands have to deal with. So they'll have to adapt for that. And other things are, you know, convenience and free shipping and things like that. But brand loyalty is one of them. So I think that's here to stay. And the pandemic has definitely accelerated that trend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I thought when reading this article was that maybe brand loyalty before meant I have no choice because there's only one of them. And I think that more and more, especially with this podcast, about how our listeners could be listening to anything else. They could be doing many other things with their time, but have chose to listen to us, which myself and...
You should... Don't remind them.
Please don't go and do something else. But we truly, truly appreciate it more than you guys realize. But yeah, there's just so many things you could do. And now there are so many brands that you could purchase from. And so maybe now if someone was with your brand, it means more than it used to because there are so many other options, perhaps. That's what we've got time for the game of the week. This week's winner. Very close game, gents. Very close indeed. But I'll take a drum roll. Oscar, just at the end, sneaks the win. Yes. But that was very, very close. Some excellent points. Oscar, congratulations. You get the championship belt and the last word. What do you want to tell us?
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you. I think that was close, but it's always tough with very Rahul close. And Blake. So yeah. Great. So what I wanted to allot 30 seconds to was just, you know, and frequent listeners know I either talk about sports or sports. Probably that's all I talk about here when I have a little time to mention something, but wanted to give a special shout out to Lionel Messi for winning his 7th record-breaking Ballon d'Or yesterday. 7. That's 2 ahead of the second place guy, Cristiano Ronaldo. Only 3 other players have won it 3 times, so 7 is incredible. For those of the listeners who don't know what the Ballon d'Or is, it's an award that's given out yearly, although it was canceled last year due to COVID, to the best player in the world who had the best season in soccer. We're talking about soccer year. And it's voted on by a jury of journalists representing many different footballing nations. So, you know, people from all around the world vote for it. He's truly, truly the GOAT. He's earned it. And I just wanted to give a shout out to him, Lionel Messi.
How old is he now? Has he still got a good couple of years?
34. Yeah, hopefully. Hmm. Hopefully he can go another 3-4 years. Let's see.
Okay. Is he seen as is he surpassed Ronaldo or Maradona as the GOAT?
Oh, yes. Yes. I think personally a long time ago. Most people would argue it's Messi. The only thing he's missing is that World Cup win with Argentina, but he won the Copa America with them this year, and that was a big step for him to be kind of crowned the best ever.
Okay. Well, England's winning it next year, Messi. We'll so see. Keep waiting, my friend. Keep we'll waiting. See. Very good. That's all we've got time for the game of the week. It's time now for Working From Somewhere. All right, this is the segment where we talk about what it's like to work from somewhere. We probably only have a few more of these segments left. We might run this to the end of the year and then maybe have a brand new segment for you guys because we talked a lot about it. But we do have a few more articles we wanted to cover, one of them being office holiday parties. They're back and smaller than ever. Festive annual company celebrations survived the pandemic. Yay? Asks Rani Moller of Recode. Miss Moller writes that people either love or hate office holiday parties. Who the hell loves them? Who are those people? Anyway, pretty much everyone hates virtual office parties, office holiday parties, she notes. And as we enter the second pandemic holiday season, both types of events meant to celebrate employees and humanize bosses, she writes, are back. And there are, of course, different flavors. You've got the in-person parties, which are making a comeback as vaccination rates and appetites for socializing grow, though these events will be smaller and more restrained. There are some companies which are just not having one at all, instead opting for gifts, money, or additional time off. And then most holiday parties, it seems, at least according to this article, will be virtual. Gents, thoughts? Virtual office holiday parties or in-person ones? How do we feel?
I love virtual holiday parties because I really dislike holiday parties of all kinds. And I feel like if it's virtual, if you don't show up, people kind of like, are like, yeah, whatever.
They don't Irish
show
exit.
Up. But if you don't show up in person at a holiday party, then people notice and, you know, you kind of feel like obligated to be there. So, yeah.
Or you can just press the leave button and then pretend that your network connection dropped.
Yeah, like the battery died.
Yep.
It's funny. I thought my hot take was going to be that I was the Grinch that was happy to throw dirt on the coffin of the holiday office party, but maybe that's just the mainstream take on this. It seems like, at least from the sample of people on this podcast. But yeah, I don't know. I think everybody's, like you said, struggling with, like, what do we do with all these weird, like, kind of hybrid experiences now? And I'm not sure if it was this article mentioned that, you know, hybrid work-related events just generally fail. They don't work. If you're trying to do a hybrid experience, I think it's probably not going to go that well. Having said that, like, I'm probably the first person, if we're supposed to do some kind of online team building experience, my eyes are probably going to roll so hard that might detach my corneas. but then once I get into, ouch, like, you know, the actual, like, whatever, you know, taboo or whatever the game is, I get totally sucked into it and I actually have a great time. So, you know, maybe I should go in with more of an open mind about all these virtual office experiences.
I guess I'm alone here, but I love in-person holiday parties. Love those. They're a highlight of my year. I mean it.
Oscar's keeping them alive.
It's what's keeping me alive. I really do miss...
No, it's not what's keeping you alive. You're what's keeping them alive.
Oh, I'm all the business.
The only reason Oscar's alive is the only reason that is keeping him alive.
It's okay. You can. It's true too also. But yes, I'm probably keeping them alive too. No, truthfully, I do miss them. You know, this year, it'll be 2 years now without one. You know, the only thing I would add is I did also read Rahul the hybrid party idea. Let's focus on, you know, kind of making the hybrid work schedule, you know, function properly first, because if we can't even figure that out, I agree anything else hybrid is destined to fail. So that's not going to work for me. You know, I like what we're doing at our company. I love this kind of holiday concert idea thing. And so I think that that's a great idea. So just being creative with it, you know, making it a new experience for most workers, I think that's the route most companies should take.
Yeah.
Can I just spitball an idea? Like, what if we had like a battle bots with like telepresence robots, you know?
Wait, what's this?
Like just straight up robots trying to murder each other. Oh. Be a telepresence robot. You know, I think it'd be a good way to work out the aggression I feel towards like Jen in accounting for not approving all of my expenses. It's like, you know, shifts from passive aggression in the workplace to just straight up telepresence robot aggression.
I love it. Getting out there.
Never tried that. Let's do it.
Well, to Oscar's point, there were some suggestions on how not to make these awful. So one of them was no Zoom calls that last multiple hours that include everything from games to music to speeches. And Tal Brodsky, Director of Product Marketing and Business Development at Workplace Culture Marketplace, Thriver, was suggesting focusing on short and sweet but impactful things online. Another one was offering everyone a stipend for food and drink so they can buy that and then have that with them whilst they're doing the virtual thing, booking some kind of entertainment performance, maybe doing a murder mystery. The fourth suggestion was breaking it up by teams, doing some kind of just get together or team building exercises, cooking classes or escape rooms. I'm imagining you'd have to be in person. Maybe they have virtual escape rooms. That'd be interesting. So. Then choosing venues with outdoor space where possible, sometimes moving the event to the fall or the spring to take advantage of warmer weather. Not sure if that would work, but maybe. And then finally, as this was suggested earlier, additional time off or gift cards or other perks becoming popular as alternatives to holiday parties, according to the Society for Human Resource Management. The best holiday thing I ever did was at this very company, and it was when I was in the UK. I would go back to the UK for the holidays. Well, I go back every year, but this year I happened to go during their Christmas party. So I wasn't in the US for the US one. I was in London. And it was the nicest meal maybe I've ever had. It was a Crocker's Folly. It was like Northwest London. And it was this beautiful restaurant. And it was about 10 of us. It was small, intimate. You could like talk to each other, sit down, amazing dinner. And that to me was the best holiday party I've been to. ones with lots of people, I always struggle to negotiate those. So I'm not as sad that they're not here anymore. But I do miss my colleagues.
Marcus, you should take everyone, all the Weekly Listen guests out for like an intimate dinner at like a 5-star restaurant. You can pay for it.
Hey,
that'll awful. Keep it nice and small.
Moving on. Next segment, dinner party data. This is the part of the show where we tell you the most interesting thing that we've learned this week. We start with Oscar. He won the game of the week. Oscar, what have you learned recently?
Great. So today I'm going to go with my favorite topic of all, which is history. I love history. Two different but equally interesting facts for you guys. Pretty quick hitters here. One is about Britain. So we'll get to that as a second point. But let me start with the first one. So I just read research published in the journal PLOS One, PLOS One, found that for significant spans of time during the Stone Age, there were fewer than 1,500 people living in Central Europe. IFL Science reports that's about as many people as you can probably fit on a mid-sized cruise ship. So in all of Central Europe, in the Stone Age, a long time ago, only 1,500 people lived there.
Wow.
Crazy. Crazy to think about, you know, realizing that there's like 7 billion more people in the world at this point.
That's bananas.
So, yeah.
I was insane. Just looking, because I have no life, so I was looking at population numbers earlier today. And that in the year zero, there were less than 200 million people on the planet.
Insane.
Which is like, Nigeria is the 7th largest country in the world, and they have about 200 million people. So it'd be like Nigeria, if it spread its population over the whole planet, or if you took all the American adults, which is actually 250 million, but all the American adults minus a few and spread them over the planet Earth, that's how many people were here. It's insane.
Insane. I love me some population, you know, data going back to, you know,
of course you
love
do.
It, love it.
Bloody forecasting analysts.
Exactly. So the second one, last one, have you guys heard the slogan, keep calm and carry on? You've
yes,
seen
indeed.
That everywhere?
Sure. Yeah.
Did you know where it was created? Any guess? I didn't say it before, but...
Where in terms of the country? Oh, yeah.
UK,
yes,
Britain. England. Yeah. So just to give a little bit more context on it, it was created by the British government as a form of propaganda to urge citizens to stay civil during World War II. This was because London was frequently being air bombed and had to endure terrible things at that time, a few years of that. So it never caught on, though. And years later, in the early 2000s, a poster, you know, from that era was discovered. And since then, many companies have used it as a slogan or marketing theme for their products. Shows that vintage things do sometimes sell. And I do hope at some point we stop seeing so many, you know, marketing campaigns using that slogan. But a really popular one. And it was interesting to hear that started in World War II.
Huh. Very good. To keep calm. Don't get too excited and just keep doing what you've been doing. Just keep at it.
Yeah, I feel like that one's wandered into the realm of like dorm room decoration starter kit
yeah, all
at
over.
This point.
All over. I'm sick
like
of it.
A visual cliche.
Yeah. Rahul, let's go to you, my friend.
My data point was inspired by one of the articles you sent out, which said that Dorsey, quote, took a much different, less polished approach to appearing for testimony, bearded and seemingly unbothered. End quote. And the reason that stuck out to me is the implication is that he should have maybe shaved his beard before Congress. I thought it was a very strange grooming tip. But anyway, it got me thinking and I was curious, well, how many presidents have had facial hair? You know, I think in the modern era, zero. But I did a little research. I don't know if anyone has any guesses, but out of 40, I think 6 presidents now, only 10 sitting presidents have had either a beard or mustache. That number creeps up, I think, when you get into like some parts of the 19th century when mutton chops were very popular, and Taft was the most recent president to have facial hair. He sported a mustache during his one-term tenure that ended in 1913. And I did look at pictures of a bunch of these people, and for my money, Rutherford B. Hayes has like the most on-point beard game. It's like Bill Fisher-esque in its beauty. And for those who don't know, Bill Fisher is our UK analyst who's got a beard that I think is the envy of anybody who ever wanted to play bass for Metallica. Amazing.
It was pretty special. Very good. Very good indeed. Let's go, Blake.
So I got some good news for Oscar, who, as we were talking about before the recording, doesn't like dogs, but some bad news for dogs. So there's a recent poll.
Let's get real dark.
It's a recent poll asking how likely are you to buy your pets a holiday gift this year? And last year, 41% said that they were very likely to buy their pet a gift for the holidays. But this year, that number has actually dropped down to only 34% say they're likely. So, you know, I think people are, you know, maybe tightening the belt a little bit, but the pets are the ones that are suffering. So I just wanted to, you know, tell people, urge them, just get your pet a gift. You know, it doesn't have to be expensive. Just throw him a bone or something.
Pun well intended. Very well played. Yeah, so I feel like my parents, they would skip buying gifts for us, even as kids, for the sake of buying one for our dogs. So I'm wondering how much it's gone down for actual human people.
I think actually we did, that was in the eMarketer briefing a couple of days ago, that there was a statistic about the number of people who decided that they weren't buying gifts at all had increased. It wasn't like a huge percentage to begin with, but it was up this year.
It's because it's tough to know why, isn't it? Is it because we have a bit less money than normal, or is it because I like you less?
I think it's because the past year we've actually seen people in person. So it, you know, allows for a lot more time for someone to piss you off. and I think that, you know, the tension has maybe returned to our in-person relationships. Whereas when we were all apart in 2020, you know, I think absence makes the heart grow fonder. Yeah. And maybe there was more, people were in more of a giving mood because we didn't actually have to see these people. And then we see them and we realize how much they aggravate us.
We went by
so the gift giving is going down, but that's just a theory.
It's a thousand percent correct. All right, I've got two for you real quick. I've got some numbers in here, so they're interesting, but it's less of a fact. But my question is, are less people watching baseball? So, Blake, I wondered what your take was here. So this year's six-game series between the Houston Astros and the Atlanta Braves averaged 12 million, roughly, viewers on national network Fox, up from 10 million last year. Last year's six-game average from the LA Dodgers, between the LA Dodgers and the Tampa Bay Rays, which was the least watched in history. But in 2003, 25 million folks tuned into the World Series. However, Maury Brown of Forbes blames fragmentation in terms of where you can watch it and falling pay TV subscribers. Blake, what do you think?
I think that...
What's the reason?
In 2022, when Scherzer and DeGrom lead the Mets to the World Series, yes. New York's a big market, so... It's going to be the World Series viewing is going to be way up across all platforms. And hopefully Nielsen will be able to tell us how good the commercials do. Oh, no, wait, sorry. That's not until 2024.
I was looking for a real answer. Unbelievable.
It's a great answer.
Mets people.
Let's go Mets.
Oh, two Mets fans. I got Oscar. I forgot you were a bloody Mets. Forget this. Moving on. Well, no, and this actually is pretty interesting. From Morning Consult, poll from 2020 found only 32% of Gen Z Americans said they were casual or avid fans of MLB, compared to 50% of all adults. This was the biggest gap among all sports considered, and younger Americans are more interested in esports than baseball. But it's definitely not disappearing.
That's probably because the games are 5 hours long.
I wondered, is it because the games are too long? Is it because it's getting too easy to strike people out and there's not enough hitting? Why we think that maybe the numbers are going down?
There's a great New York Times article, I think it was the New York Times, where they just solicited opinions about how they could speed up Major League Baseball games, and it's worth a read if you feel like Googling something and getting a chuckle out of the ideas that poured in.
Huh. They're like like a timer for the pitcher and like a pitch, what do you call it? Pitch clock?
Pitch clock, yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, like stuff like that. But some of them were more absurd and outrageous, which were like the more radical takes were the ones that were, as a non-sports person, were entertaining to me. The idea that, you know, you'd start every inning with like a guy on second and third, but, you know, the guy would have to run backwards twice or something. I don't know. It was just like really crazy ideas that were on par with like the absurdity of going to a minor league baseball game. Like watching ketchup, race, mustard, and relish to me is like the whole point of going to a baseball game. Like the sports are secondary to that.
Yeah. One more for you guys. Only two states don't practice daylight savings time. Do you guys know which two of these are? Is this kind of common knowledge in America?
No, but I'm guessing it's some Midwestern state for farming reasons, but I could be totally wrong about that.
Oh, that's a good guess. It's not, but I think it's a fairly logical guess. Blake, any thoughts?
I don't know, but I would consider moving there.
So Hawaii and Arizona both don't observe daylight savings time. And actually, a few states have proposed to get to scrap it, but it's not passed. So why? So for Hawaii, since they're so close, they're close enough to the equator that there is no significant difference in sunrise and sunset times across the year. There are no benefits, no real benefits from changing the hour. And for Arizona, the argument is that daylight savings time is largely unnecessary, in quotes, because of Arizona's hot climate. And the argument against extending daylight savings hours is that people prefer to do their activities in the cooler evening temperatures. And the idea of daylight savings, of course, being to move an hour of sunlight from the early morning to the evening so that people can make more use of daylight. Arizona or Hawaii, Blake? Sound appealing? That's a no.
Pass. I'm going to stay in New York.
Okay. Benjamin Franklin apparently is often credited as the first to suggest daylight savings in the 18th century after he realized that he was wasting his Parisian mornings by staying in bed during his time as an American delegate in Paris in 1784, according to the New York Times. That's all we've got time for today's episode. Thank you so much to my guests for hanging out. Thank you so much to Blake.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Rahul.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you to Oscar.
Thanks for having me, Marcus.
This week's winner of the game of the week. Thanks to Victoria. She edits the show. Thanks to everyone listening. If you've got any questions, just want to say hi, you can email us at podcast@emarketer.com. We'll see you guys on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Basis Technologies. Happy weekends. Before I get roped into paying for stuff I don't want to.
But the Yankees aren't paying you enough?
Oh, I'm a relief pitcher. I'm not making for, the for big the, bucks.
For a visual, Marcus is wearing a pinstripe shirt today on the Zoom. And he looks like he just got signed by the Yankees.
Maybe I did.